Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
A lot of the process of researching the afterlife consists in deciding just what is and what is not a genuine contact with beings who are not now in bodies. I am a skeptic by nature, and I've turned away a lot of what was probably good channeled material because I never really give this stuff any chance. There's no benefit of the doubt with me. If I can't absolutely verify that the source is legitimate, I won't even touch it. That was then, and this is now. A couple of years ago, I met Garnet Schulhauser. Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes, and our guest this week is someone I have to admit that I identify with, because like me, Garnet is an attorney by profession. Although he's now retired, he wonders when I will. I'm not sure. As I told him, I have to keep practicing till I get it right. Like me, Garnet also thought he didn't have psychic abilities until his spirit guide broke into his life, which actually is against the spirit guide code, apparently, but he and I have both had it happen to us. However, here's where we diverge. Unlike me, Garnet's spirit guide, Albert, has taken him on a series of out-of-body journeys, and many of these will boggle your mind. A lot of what Garnet writes doesn't pass scrutiny with me at all. I just couldn't believe it. However, I cannot dismiss his books because the things he writes about the greater reality are so remarkably detailed and consistent with what the most expert afterlife researchers have learned. It's impossible, in other words, and I hate to even say this, it seems impossible to me that all of this is not real, even though I'm still trying to get my arms around it. I would love to dismiss what Garrett does so I wouldn't have to think about things like, you know, ancient civilizations, fairies, talking to Gaia. Here is where I'm going to start to bend your mind as well. But one of the things we're going to do today, and I love this, this is just an aside. People ask me a lot about sex in the afterlife, and I have to say ixnay to that. It doesn't happen because there's something better. Nobody believes me. Well, today I'm going to read Garnet's description of what happened to him, so wait for that. The thing about Garnet, I think, more than anything else, is that his books are fun to read. They're enjoyable. And they'll tell you the truth. I don't know what better endorsement I can give than that. So with that prelude, welcome, Garnet. We're going to have fun today. This is going to be fun.
Thank you for having me, Roberta. I'm really looking forward to it. This is my third time on your show, and I'm sure it's going to be just wonderful.
Yes, I wasn't sure what Garnet had done the last time, the first time, which was Dancing on a Stamp. And it was kind of a quirky little book, and I loved the notion of Albert meeting him when he was a bum, sort of being on the street and begging, but he turned out to be his spirit guide. That was all charming, and it was a charming book. I consider this book to be serious afterlife research. I hate to even say those words, and a lot of people will say I've gone crazy, but I haven't, because I have not seen anything in Garnet's books that's not consistent with what we're told by people who are in a position to know, who are actually dead and are verifiable dead expert communicators. So I'm not sure even where to begin. That's part of the problem with this book. We could start just about anywhere. I don't want to rehearse your meeting of Albert, but maybe you could just tell us quickly what happened that day. You were still practicing law, and none of this really was anything you ever thought of, right? And then he walked up to you?
Yeah, I was still practicing law, and I just went for a stroll down the street one afternoon in May, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this homeless man just jumps out in front of me. And he looked like a typical homeless man, except that he had these amazing, dazzling, sparkling blue eyes. And what they did was his gaze was penetrating deep within me, down to the depths of my soul, and I felt that he knew everything about me, even though we'd never met before. And at the same time, his gaze was sending me this amazing gush of pure, unconditional love that was infusing my whole body with an amazing sense of peace and security and well-being. So that was the beginning of that was my first meeting. after the first meeting, we had a second meeting right when I found him sitting on a bench the next day, and we sat down and began a dialogue that went off and on for a couple of months. And he told me his name was Albert, and that he was one of my spirit guides in disguise. And so that eventually led to the writing of my first book, Dancing on a Stamp.
And he has taken you on, you had never gone out of body, right, before?
No, not that I was aware of. And so in the second set of encounters with me were a bit different than the first one. He basically showed up as an astral form in my bedroom one night, and he said to me, I'm going to take you on some out-of-body adventures. I want to show you things on the spirit side, introduce you to people, show you other things in the universe, and I want you to write about them in your second book. Because he said, I believe a picture is worth 1,000 words. And so rather than me just tell you about what I want you to write about, I want you to see it yourself.
Yeah,
so then,
wow.
So then he just literally pulled my astral body out of my physical body, and we rose up through the ceiling and up through the clouds, and eventually we ended up going through a shimmering doorway to the spirit side, and that was the beginning of my first astral trip with Albert.
I should just amend what I said, because of course we all travel out of body at night, but very few people learn to do it in the daytime. Some people really try to learn to do it, but you had the help of somebody who basically did it for you. He engineered you out of your body, so that made it relatively easy. Maybe scary the first time, but perhaps he kept you from being afraid?
Well, I was a little bit scared at first, because when he first pulled my astral body out, I turned around and I looked, and my physical body was still asleep in bed. So I had the usual concerns like, well, will I ever get back there, and where am I going, kind of thing. But Albert is very wise and compassionate and very comforting, and so I soon became very comfortable. And after my very first trip, when he brought me back home, I slipped back into my physical body. After that, I knew that, okay, this is a safe way to travel, and I'm always going to come back, and I'm safe in the hands of Albert. So my initial fear didn't last very long, Roberta.
Well, you're a brave man. But the first thing he did was to start to give you some education, right? Each of the trips was planned for additional education. I'm looking actually at your table of contents. Tell me about the little people. This one really freaked me out, because, you know, there are tales in Ireland of leprechauns, and they are the little people. They live under the ground. But, of course, those are legends, right?
Well, that's what I thought, too. I always thought it was a legend. They were just fabled creatures that somebody's vivid imagination created. But he actually took me to Ireland to meet one of the little people. She was a beautiful little person. Her name was Brina. She was a fairy. She was about 3 feet tall. And she looked like a tiny, perfect China doll, just exquisite. And so I had a conversation with her, by telepathy, of course, and she said that their people had been living on that island and other islands nearby for eons. And they had a very happy existence until humans arrived. And at first they thought that humans were just larger versions of themselves. And so they welcomed us with open arms. But later, to their chagrin, they found out that we were violent and aggressive, and they didn't really want to be around us. And so they sort of basically moved to underground cities, where they've been ever since. They show up occasionally, and humans do spot them, but they're basically very careful to stay hidden. And not just because they do not want to have contact with us. And it was really a shame, because she said they really did enjoy being able to have roam freely, openly, you know, on the land and in the daylight.
Like above ground.
Yeah, above ground. And they were restricted to sort of coming out at night here and there. And they said, you know, why can't you humans learn to live with the other creatures on your planet in peace and harmony and not be abusive? And once you do that, we'll come out again and we'll be able to live together in harmony. So it was really a kind of an interesting story. And it was one that, you know, I've heard echoed in a lot of my different astral travels, is that humans are bad news to a lot of the other inhabitants of our planet, and we really need to change our ways.
We're actually bad news to the universe, which is pretty pathetic, but that's a standard thing we've come to know. The Earth is, if not the most dangerous place and aggressive place to evolve your consciousness, it's one of them. And everybody tells us this, everybody who's out of body. And it's a mark of, how can we call it, bravery. It's a mark of confidence. We are the Marines of the universe, just because we even choose to be here. But the problem is that it's so infected with negativity. This planet is. We think it's normal because it's like we're fish swimming in it. We just don't know anything else. But that's one of the things your book does, is to help us to see ourselves as others see us. And it's really not a pretty picture. And I want to talk about what they've told you your purpose is. But I think just even reading these chapters, each one of which is a little gem, there, as I say, I have a lot of trouble believing a lot of this just because that's who I am. I'm very skeptical. But on the other hand, they're beautiful stories all by themselves, and what comes out of them are, as far as I've looked at in all three of your books, I haven't seen anything I didn't think was real, was something that would come from someone who actually knew what they were talking about. So that to me is remarkable, really remarkable, Garnet. Let's talk about your conversation with the earth, which is, this is early in the book, and when I came to it, I said, I can't go on. This is just beyond what I can believe. But I kept going, and no, I guess I can believe anything at this point now that I know you. Tell us about that.
Well, it was Albert took me on one of my astro trips. He took me, actually, we went, sort of hovered over the North Pole, dropped down through the ice and the water, ended up in a cavern underneath the North Pole. And I was wondering, well, you know, there was nobody there. Albert, why are you bringing me here? And then all of a sudden, there it was. I started a conversation by telepathy with Gaia, who is the consciousness of our planet. You know, she said to me, I'm the sum total of all the rocks and rivers and deserts and trees and mountains and, you know, on this third rock from the sun, but I do have a consciousness. I am a conscious, feeling, thinking being, you know, everything on this planet is really sort of part of me, including all of my, you know, all of my animals and all the plants and so on. And so I was a bit surprised at this, but she was a very compelling sort of personality. And she said, you know, I'm very distressed at how humans have been abusing not only the other creatures that you share your planet with, but abusing me with your pollution. You know, you poison my rivers and spill toxic chemicals into my soil and spew noxious fumes into my atmosphere. And I'm very unhappy about this because before you guys came along, we had a beautiful planet, a beautifully balanced, you know, biosphere where everything sort of lived together in harmony without any sort of undue interruptions. And you guys have upset the whole apple cart. And she was
right.
Very unhappy about this.
Well, she would be, yes. This is something which is on the edge of what we have learned. How is it possible that the planet could be conscious? The only thing that exists is consciousness energy. That's what all of matter is made up of. Really, nothing else exists. So perhaps it is not, it's a little bit hard to believe, but it may not be impossible to believe that, therefore, aggregate consciousness, like the matter of the planet, would develop awareness, which is what we're really talking about here. I don't know, but my mind is much more open now that I've read your book. But let's talk about the terrorist. You met a terrorist, too. What did he say?
Yeah, he was someone who had just recently crossed over. He'd actually been killed in the Hamas-Israeli conflict in 2014. And he was in a recuperation hospital on the spirit side. And that's a place where souls who've died violent and tragic deaths or who cross over with a lot of remorse and guilt because of what they did on Earth, that's where they sort of go to help them make the transition to the spirit side. And there they're wrapped in a cocoon of tender, loving care by the hospital staff, the souls there who man the facility. And so I went there to see him. Albert took me there. And he said that he had been a Palestinian terrorist in Gaza. And it had started when the whole thing started when he was seven and a stray Israeli missile hit his family's home, killing his mother and father and siblings and wiping out their home. The enemy was put into a foster home. But he had this need for revenge against the Israeli people. And when he had turned 12, he joined a terrorist organization and began, you know, killing and maiming innocent Israeli citizens as a means of revenge for the death of his family. And at 15, he traveled to Afghanistan, went to a terrorist training camp so he could learn to become more effective at killing people. Then he came back to Gaza and continued on his ways, blowing up people, shooting innocent Israelis, and luring other innocent young people to strap bombs to their bodies and go into restaurants and bus stations and blow themselves up. So he was on a real trail of terror, and he just couldn't seem to stop himself. And he admitted that he basically, he didn't believe in Allah or the dogmas of Islam, but he was driven solely by the need for revenge. And it was all-consuming. He couldn't sort of think about anything else, and he couldn't seem to stop himself. And he said that he actually had a subconscious death wish near the end, hoping that somebody would kill him because that's the only way he would stop his killing. And so eventually, he got hit by this Israeli missile, And he crossed over and he was telling me, he said, you know, he said, I'm very sorry for what I did. I'm a prime example of somebody whose life was overcome by negative emotions, in this case, hatred and the need for revenge. And he just wasn't able to hear what his guides were telling him. He wasn't able to see anything but his blind fury that drove him to just kill innocent people. And so he was a prime example of a terrorist. But when he gets back over to the spirit side, of course, he has a life review. He can see the whole picture. And he said, you know, I'm really sorry. I wish I hadn't gone off the rails like that. And he said, I'm really anxious to sort of plan out another life on Earth so I can go back and try to make amends for what I did, in my last life. So it was a very, very heartbreaking sort of story. This guy was clearly, once he was, you know, freed from his physical body, he was no longer a terrorist. And he recognized that what he had done was very wrong. But
Right. Yeah, but that's actually, people ask me sometimes what happens with the terrorists. And, of course, we have very little information. This is a recent phenomenon, terrorists for religious purposes. And in his case, just because of his tragic history. So that I thought that was something people would enjoy hearing. And I know that some of people listening are not sure just how Garnet's able to go under the ice and do all these things. Well, we're built like Matryoshka dolls, Russian dolls. We're nested energy bodies. We see the outer material body, but that's not all that we are. Internally, we have what we think is probably a set of those nested bodies. And the astral body seems to be the one that's next in from the material body, and that easily leaves every night, just about, if not every night. You travel astrally. We all do. It's part of being human. And at night, all we're doing usually is just being out of our body for a while the body sleeps, you know, sort of smoking a metaphysical cigarette while we're hanging around because our minds don't need to sleep. We often meet with our loved ones. We think we never see them. We see them all the time who have gone before us. We meet with our guides. We get together sometimes with people who are still in bodies because we're working on some relationship issues or other issues. There are all kinds of things we all do. But what Garnet is able to do, because of Albert, is to do this while he is awake. And therefore, he can go anywhere. We're going to talk in a minute about his going across the universe. He can do anything because he's still attached to the body that's in that bed beside his wife by what the Bible calls a silver cord. It's an energy cord which is so elastic that he can travel to the edge of the universe. And since we travel by mind when we're traveling astrally, he can do it in an eye blink. So I hope that helps you understand that this is something which we afterlife researchers know can happen. For me, it's not the travels that are sort of straining my ability to understand and believe. It's the sum of the experiences he has, things which have been conjectured sometimes, but here Albert's meeting them, which I got to tell you is quite remarkable. You went to the center of a black hole. Right? I mean...
Yeah, I did, yeah. And that was one of the most frightening trips I've ever had with Albert. I had a number of trips, as you could tell by reading my book, to view scenes that were quite distressing, disturbing.
I'm not talking about those because I like it to be a happy book.
Yeah, no, I know. but none of those were particularly frightening. The black hole encounter was frightening. And I wasn't quite sure why Albert took me there, but we went near the center of the galaxy. You know, a black hole is one of those... collapsed stars where the gravitation field is so strong that nothing can escape, not even light. That's why they call them black holes. Anyway, we plunged down into this black hole, and all of a sudden, Albert disappeared, and there I was plunged into this total and complete blackness, and I sensed total sensory deprivation. I couldn't feel, hear, or see anything, had no sense of passing time. It was like I was in a pit of black despair, and I could feel the panic welling up in my chest because he wasn't around. And I couldn't tell how long I'd been there or if I'd ever get out. And I thought for a second, maybe I'm in hell, even though Albert told me there was no hell.
Right.
Maybe he was pulling my leg and he lured me here to this awful place and he was going to leave me. And so it's quite frightening. And then after some point in time, I have no idea because I can't tell about the passing time. I see a pinprick of light way off in the distance, a very tiny one. So my hopes swelled up. The light started moving closer towards me. Soon it just totally engulfed me. And then I found myself in basically a subatomic world. where there was like I could see an atom, the nucleus and the electrons orbiting around, and then some invisible force was pushing me, zooming me away from the atom. Then I noticed other atoms had clung to the first atom to form a molecule, and then as I went further out, there was more molecules. Eventually, I found out the molecules formed a shiny black substance that sparkled into light, and I found myself emerging from the glass eye of a teddy bear sitting on the shelf in my family room. And it's like, I'm like, how did I end up back here? And then Albert
story.
Was beside me, and Albert said, he was chuckling. He said, yes. I left you there because I wanted you to experience the total feeling of sadness by being all alone. And he said, I was there beside you, but you couldn't see me, and you were only there for like 30 seconds, so it's no big deal. So you don't get over it, because I was a bit upset
it.
With him.
Yeah, that's a lot. But that was interesting to me, because basically you became, your awareness became subatomic in size. And that's another thing which we would conjecture can happen, because there's no such thing as space. There's no such thing as relative size. Those are all artifacts of materiality. So when you're in your astral body, what happened there seems to me to be perfectly possible. I've just never seen it described before, and I thought it was really quite interesting.
Yeah, and he said, I asked him, how did I get back from the black hole to my house and standing in my family room? He said the space-time continuum is curved in many more ways than you can even imagine, and you came back through an interdimensional wormhole. That's how he described it. But anyway, I was happy to get back in my house and
yes.
away from that awful black hole.
Oh, yeah, wow. There are other things. I want to talk when we come back about Catholicism. You've been a Catholic, so have I, and I think it's very interesting, some of the things that you've learned. But meanwhile, I'm just going to mention, this is Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. My nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, Liberating Jesus, and My Thomas. And you can learn about all my books and find my blog at robertagrimes.com. Our guest today is Garnet Schulhauser, a mild-mannered attorney by day who travels astrally with his spirit guide in the evening, and he writes amazingly, and we're going to learn who it is who helps him with his writing. But his latest book is Dance of Heavenly Bliss, and we're going to learn in a minute what that means. The book is a treasure. Now, let's talk about the Pope. I thought this was fascinating. I remember this vividly. One of my children had just been born when he was elected Pope, and she was a tiny baby, and suddenly he was gone, John Paul I. You met him. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I met him. He's on the spirit side. He's a very wise and compassionate soul, and Albert brought me to meet him because he wanted me to hear his story. And, of course, we all heard, as you mentioned, that he was a Pope for about 33 days, and then he died mysteriously.
Right. Yeah.
And they didn't do an autopsy, and nobody really knew what was going on. So I met with this guy, and he said, "Oh yeah, well, there's nothing mysterious about it. I was poisoned. I was murdered." And I said,
"I thought that at the time. It was otherwise, it could not have happened as it did."
Yeah, and he confirmed this. And I said, "Well, why was that?" And he said, "Well, because I had some radical views when I was elected, and I let the other cardinals know, the people in the Vatican, that I wanted to change some of the things I thought were just wrong with the Church. The main one of which was the prohibition on artificial contraception." And he
right.
said he thought that was just a wrong-headed policy. And he wanted, and he said that was one of his first major goals, was to abolish this, to change it. But there were so many old thinking, misguided minds in the Vatican and the College of Cardinals that this was just abhorrent to them. Like, you can't change this. Their view was popes are infallible. So if the previous pope said you can't have artificial contraception, and if you say you can, that means that they were wrong and that's not possible. So you can't do it. And they were so upset and so concerned that he was going to proceed that they hired an assassin to poison him. And then he just quickly covered it up, didn't do an autopsy, buried
right.
his body. And so that's what happened. And I said, "Do you know who did it?" And he said, "Well, yeah, of course, I've met them here. They've since passed on the spirit side, but I'm not going to tell you because it won't serve any purpose to identify them."
No.
But it was insiders in the Vatican. And he said, that just demonstrates the sort of the wrong-headed thinking that the Church leaders have had over the centuries and still did back in, when he was a Pope, and they probably still do today. And he said it's a tragedy, and he really hopes that someday they will change their ways. But so far, it doesn't look good, other than Pope Francis, and he didn't mention this, but I'm just making this comment. Pope Francis seems to have some different ideas, and hopefully he can deploy them and make some changes in the Church. And as you say, I was raised as
a
Roman Catholic, as were you, so you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes. There's another meeting you had with a Catholic who had been a priest in life and had abused children. I think this is, if we want to talk about the sins of the church, my husband, who, I don't practice Catholicism anymore, longer story than I want to tell, but I love Christianity, I still do, but I found I couldn't be a Christian because it made me fearful, and you can't love what you fear. So I chose loving God over being Christian, and it still makes me sad to have to say that. But one of the great sins of the church is this nonsense about insisting on celibate clergy. So one of the things then that's happened, of course, is that the church has had this terrible stain of child abuse. And you met an abuser, right?
I did. Yep. He had formerly been a priest in Ireland. And he had told me the story of his life. He had grown up in a religious Catholic family in Dublin. And he was a typical red-blooded Irish boy, you know, that had sexual drives and dated girls.
He was normal, right?
Yeah, he was normal. And but eventually, started to adore his parish priest and thought, well, he'd follow in his footsteps. So he went into the seminary, came out as a priest, and eventually he was assigned to his own parish outside of Dublin. And he was good for a while, but he just said that his sexual urges suddenly just became unbearable, and he couldn't control them. So he started molesting, you know, altar boys in his rectory. And he felt badly about it, but he just couldn't seem to control himself. And eventually one of the parents complained to the bishop, and the bishop hauled him in, and he confessed everything to the bishop. And the bishop said, okay, well, confess your sins and promise not to do you again. And he shifted him off to another parish.
Different parish, right.
The thing repeated again. He tried his best to not abuse children, but he couldn't help himself, and he started doing it again. And so after a couple or three parishes, finally the bishop threw in the towel and put him in a post in the diocese where he wouldn't have contact with children. But he says, you know, he's very sorry for the abuse he heaped on these children, but he said that the main cause was that he was the church's policy that he had to remain celibate, and he had no normal outlet for his sexual drive, and
right.
It ended up being distorted and convoluted into aiming it towards helpless young boys. And he said that was the cause of it. It was the policy of celibacy. He really wished they would change that, and he was sorry for what he did, but he said, you know, sometimes you just can't, no matter how you try, you can't stifle some natural urges that you have being a normal human.
You're normal. That's exactly right. I thought that was really interesting. We tend to think that when people do evil things, they're evil people. And I think that as that story shows, and actually as all of your meetings with people who have been alive on Earth show, they're not evil people. It's the culture that they lived in here. It's the negativity of the planet itself that stressed them to the point where they did evil things, but they're not evil people. And you also met Lucifer, right? Talk about Lucifer. I thought this was cute.
Well, that was a surprise, because Albert had told me before that Satan did not exist. It was just an invention of religious holy men. So then he surprised me one day by saying, look, I'm going to take you to visit Lucifer, who some people refer to as the Prince of Darkness. And I thought he was pulling my leg. Anyway, so I go and I meet this soul, Lucifer. And Lucifer is a very kind, gentle, compassionate soul, very wise. And he says that, yeah, no, that Satan does not exist. He is not Satan. He's been maligned over the years by some humans who started ascribing that feature to him, and they claimed he was one of God's fallen angels. He said, couldn't be further from the truth. He said, actually, I spend a lot of time trying to influence people on earth to try to curtail, stop, and prevent evil. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I'll give you a couple examples. And he was boasting a bit here. He said that he sent a lot of strong messages to President Lincoln to encourage him to abolish slavery. And he said that one worked pretty well.
Yes.
And he sent messages to the team of Nazi scientists working on the development of the A-bomb for Hitler in World War II to drag their feet so that Hitler would not have a bomb available during that war. So that was a very happy situation. And then
right.
He said that he persuaded, basically through telepathic messages, persuaded Nikita Khrushchev from starting World War III during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962.
Oh, my goodness. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and you and I, of course, remember 1962, Roberta.
Listeners may not, but we
all thought we were on the brink of World War III, and of course, Lucifer claimed credit for stopping that. But in any event, he was a very likable soul, and said that's so he's basically a polar opposite of what people regard him as.
See, he turned out to be a good guy.
He's a good guy.
Wait, you met with your one of your guardian angels. I was sure before I started this chapter that here I was going to catch you. The afterlife researchers have come to understand angels. They're a separate class. They don't ever incarnate, and their primary purpose in our lives is to keep us physically alive, which we're told is very difficult for them even to do. They don't always succeed, but they usually do, to keep us alive long enough to be able to live out our life plans and get to a planned exit point. So you got that right, too. I'm amazed. Tell me about the meeting with your angels. With your one angel.
Yeah, guardian angel. She was my guardian angel. Her name was Anna Peel. Beautiful creature. She didn't have white wings sprouting from her shoulders, but she's a very beautiful lady. And she said, you know, I've been with you since you were born, and it's my job is to make sure you don't suffer an untimely death before your soul is ready to exit. And Albert had told me before that we don't die by accident. We die when souls are ready to leave the incarnation. And she said, but because there's all these humans running around with free will, and there's always a clash of interactions, she says that sometimes an event might happen that's not contemplated by your soul, which could result in your physical death before your soul is ready to go. She says, that's where I come in, and the other guardian angels, is that we're there to manipulate events so that that doesn't happen. And sometimes it's merely by sending a strong telepathic thought to you, like if you're about to board a plane that's going to crash, they will send you a strong thought that you should change your plans. And if that doesn't work, they might make your tire go flat on the way to the airport so you miss your flight.
Right.
And there's various ways they can do it. And she said most of the time people don't even realize that we've intervened to save their butts. But we're there. And she actually named a few situations in my past life which I thought I was just fortunate to have escaped death or injury. She says, well, no, it wasn't luck. It was me there manipulating things. And when she told me about them, I thought, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But that's their job, and they're there they're always watching over us. And as you say, sometimes it can be a very busy job because we can always manage to find ways to get ourselves into a mess.
Yes.
But they're there to pull us out. And then, you know, and so then when somebody does die by, say, in a car accident, it's not because their guardian angel was asleep at the switch. It's because their soul wanted to leave at that point. That was an exit point. So it was a wonderful story. It was very comforting to know that somebody like that was watching over me 24/7.
Yeah, we always have at least one guardian angel taking care of us all the time. And we're told that if that being were not so vigilant, it would be, I mean, anything could kill us, from a microbe to a freight train. Anything could go wrong. There is so much, as you say, with free will and just with being in such a fundamentally dangerous place. So it is comforting, isn't it, to know you have them. We have two classes of beings then taking care of us. We have our spirit guides who have been in bodies and are basically people who happen to have taken the role when they're out of body temporarily between lives or after they've finished incarnating. They just take the role in our lives of helping us to live out our life plans. And then there's this other class of angelic beings, and their job is just to see that we don't die before we get as much done as possible. One more thing I would like, one more of your little trips I'd like to talk about, and then I'd like to go on and talk about some more general things. But you went to what you call the birthing sun. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was looked like a typical sort of star, or like our sun, you know, the center of the galaxy. And as we were hovering sort of, outside of it, I noticed what looked like to be like sparks of light that were sort of being spun out and flowing out from this sun. And they were sort of landing on one of the large planets orbiting this sun. Albert said this was the birthing sun. He said those sparks of light are new souls being spun out from the central sun of the source. And they were being, you know, being created in their own individual aspects, and they were basically starting their exploration of the universe, if you want. And I watched as they went onto this planet, and there was a master soul there basically giving them an orientation into, guess what, this is what the physical universe is like, And here's the places you can incarnate. Here's what to expect. And you know, it was like a group of new employees being oriented into a new business.
Right. What's interesting to me about that is there is another account of someone going to see souls being created and spinning off, and it's a very similar description. These sort of entities being spun off from a central source. And that other description I read, I'm sure there could be more, but the other one that I read was from Journeys Out of the Body, Far Journeys, Ultimate. I think it was from Ultimate Journey with Bob Monroe. So I believe there is such a place and such a thing happening. Why could it be happening now? Because there is no time. Anything that ever happened or ever will happen is happening now in a way we can't understand because we're so obsessed with time. But that makes, again, perfect sense. So has Albert told you why you were chosen to do this? Because certainly it's nothing you sought, not during this lifetime anyway.
No, and I did ask him a question. He said it was because in some of my previous lives on Earth, I had demonstrated, maybe I had been a writer, I don't know, I demonstrated some ability to write, and they thought, okay, some of that may leak through to this life, and so they thought, let's give it a shot, and they thought that having a legal career before my writing career was a good basis, a good stepping stone, and you're probably finding it out yourself, Roberta,
yes.
And so that was the reason. He wasn't very specific, he just said that was, of course, it was all planned before I was born. It's part of my life plan that I would hook up with Albert, but I don't remember my life plan as you don't, and it was all planned beforehand, and he said, and he was happy. He said he thought it worked out fine. You know, he could make anybody his messenger. He has a number of messengers, but he wanted somebody who he thought would be able to write books in a clear and cogent fashion that would be understandable by all people. And so that was his direction to me as I'm writing my books, is make them clear, easy to understand, and easy to read. And so hopefully I've done that.
Yes. Well, your books are very entertaining. They read almost like novels, but they're the chapters are short, and therefore everything is very manageable. Even if people think, I don't want to read a book, this is a book you can read in little bites, and each one of the bites is delicious. I think that there is a conscious effort being made on the upper levels to choose serious people now to be doing this work. We went through a New Age period, which I guess was to introduce new ideas, and that's over really now. I mean, the whole New Age concept of there are things we can't understand and we're therefore everything is woo-woo is past. So I was told I was selected to write Liberating Jesus. I mean, I was already going to write a book that my spirit guide had written when he was alive, and then he felt it was the wrong time to publish it. So he wanted me to write it now because it's the right time. I already knew that, but I learned subsequently that in the mid-80s, it was decided that the master was going to write his definitive book, and I was chosen to do that because I was what they thought of as someone who was sort of above reproach in terms of my credibility. Again, a lawyer, someone with research ability, and they wanted someone who knew the afterlife. I don't know how many people have that combination, but they tell me that's why I was picked. I think that it's a deliberate choice. I'm not at all surprised that you chose to be coming in with that plan. You chose to be a lawyer because it gives you credibility, and it also, I think it makes us analytical in our thinking. It was a terrible sort of shock for you, wasn't it, to have to come out with this to people who knew you as a lawyer? Because
oh, yes.
I had trouble coming out the first time I had to tell people what I'd written. What did they say?
Absolutely, Roberta, yes, because I was very much of a straight-laced, button-down corporate lawyer. Never talked about religion or spirituality or anything. And so it was so many people were just, their jaws just dropped when I wrote my first book and they read about it. It was like, can this be coming out of this guy? The guy
yeah,
we knew
right.
for all these years?
Right.
Not just my partners, but my clients and friends and relatives and everything else. So many of them were surprised. Some of them actually basically thought I was losing my mind, and I haven't really had any contact with them since. A lot of the other ones sent me a very nice email saying, thank you for having the courage of coming out of the spiritual closet and writing your book, and good for you. So I lost some friends along the way, gained many more new ones, so overall it's been a very positive experience.
Yes, but it was scary. It was for me as well, and I have clients even now that will not acknowledge I do any of this work. They have me in a role, and that's the role I have in their lives, and that's fine with me too. I want to tell people what it is, and you say it very well, I think. You describe it well in your book. Why do the people who have transitioned, knowing how obsessed human beings are with sex on Earth, why don't they care about it in the afterlife? Well, for one reason is that they don't have sex drives. A lot of what people are doing is satisfying a bodily urge. But there's a bigger reason, and it's really simple. There's something they do that's a whole lot better. It's better, and it's something that has no morality attached to it, and you don't have to be lovers. You don't have to be anything. You met someone who had been in your life a lot in the past, and you frequently had been spouses, even though now he's a male and you're a male. There were occasions where you had been husband and he wife, and there were occasions when he had been husband and you wife. And there's a lovely story there of one of the occasions when he was a husband and Garnet was the wife. We do change genders, and that's one of the reasons we have some gender confusion when we're on Earth. There's some bleed through sometimes. But this comes at the end of the book. Votan, that's his name, stood up and motioned for me to do likewise. Then without further ado, and this is just the way they describe it in other accounts, he stepped toward me and merged himself into my astral body. It felt like Votan and I had somehow fused our spirits into one clump of energy. My whole body tingled with a surge of divine love that left me aching with ineffable pleasure as wave after wave of orgasmic euphoria rippled through my body in a rhapsody of sheer delight. Okay, I hope this is going to be an R-rated episode. That's what they do. And you can do it with anybody, and you can do it anytime you feel like it, and that's why who the heck wants physical sex when you can do that? Thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain it, because most people can't believe there could be something better. It's what amounts to effectively a whole body orgasm that has no emotion, no morality attached with it, that is pure divine love. And of course, this freaked you out a little bit afterwards because of what had happened, but they don't feel that way at all. This is perfectly normal in the afterlife levels. We have so much waiting for us there, which is beyond our ability to even grasp what the love is that God has for each of us, or the source has for each of us. I want to read something else too. The problem that we have right now is that we are on a course to destruction on this planet. I've been told it'll take about 200 years, and getting there will be a horrible, horrible process. So many people at the very highest levels of reality are coming together and have, I think it started almost 100 years ago, maybe even more than 100 years ago, but it's intensified dramatically in the last few decades. They're working to raise the consciousness of the planet, of all the people on it. And this is something you asked Albert about, and are we going to survive? Albert looked thoughtful as he responded. There is always hope for your civilization, but it's not a foregone conclusion. The source created Earth and all of its creatures as a way to experience life on the denser plains that has been content to let life in your planet follow its own path without any interference. Unfortunately, your human civilization has strayed off course by allowing fear to rule its actions, and the only way to conquer fear is through love. If you can fully embrace love for all humans and for Mother Earth and all of her creatures, fear and all of its spin-off emotions like anger, hate, greed will melt away like a snowbank in the spring. That's beautiful, and it's true. That's what we're facing if we cannot learn to rise above the negativity. And here you say it's fear-based, or rather Albert does. I think that's a reasonable supposition. Fear is the opposite of love. Where one exists, you cannot really have the other. And so where we should have love as the primary driving force of this planet, we have fear. And fear has given rise to so many other things which are negative. And this is the process of turning it around. That's what my life's work turns out to have been all along. And Garnet, that's what your life's work turns out to have been all along. We just didn't know it as we were, you know, going around along our happy lives and just thinking we were doing these things just for us, practicing law, and in my case, doing afterlife research. all of this is coming together to work to raise everybody's consciousness. It's already happening. I can see it happening in my audiences. I don't know if you, do you have that sense too? Because I know you're speaking a lot.
Yes, I do. And the level of consciousness has really increased dramatically over the last even, 5 years in my view.
Yes, totally.
It seems to be intensifying even more, and I hope that we can keep the ball rolling, Roberta, because I think that's really what all of us, I mean, you're doing your job, I'm trying to do my job, and there's thousands and thousands of other people around the world who are channeling spirit, and that's our job, is to try to raise the consciousness of our fellow humans and so that we can take the next step up the spiritual ladder. And so that's what we have to do, and I think we're making progress, but we have a long ways to go yet.
We're making progress. We have a long way to go. But I think that the Dance of Heavenly Bliss, especially of your books, is very valuable because it gives people truth coated in candy. The things that you say in this book, as I say, I looked for them. I could find not a single mistake, what I would call a mistake, that's inconsistent with the afterlife evidence. It's all much truer, I think, than you even realize. So Dance of Heavenly Bliss fills an important place, I think, in our effort to raise the consciousness, because what it does is to give people who aren't really interested in getting serious about this stuff, it gives them a way to read these enjoyable little stories, and in each of them, learn more about what actually is going on. I can't vouch for the thing, for events that give rise to this information. I don't think I still believe in little people or Sasquatch. You met him too. I don't really believe that stuff because I haven't seen enough evidence for it. But I believe the truths that come from these lovely stories. And so I think your book is very valuable. I'm going to recommend it to people.
Thank you very much, Roberta. I really appreciate that. Your words are very kind. And it's especially welcoming when it's coming from somebody like you who's done so much afterlife research and who's very well respected in that field. So that's quite a compliment coming from you.
Well, thank you for that. But I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. Now, how will people get in touch with you if they want to know more?
Well, my website's the best source, Roberta, and that's garnetschulhalzer.com, which is hard to remember, but if they Google dancing on a stamp, they will get to my website, and there's information about all my books. You can download a free excerpt. There's buy links there to all the popular online stores where you can click on it and immediately get to a place where you can buy my books. I have book videos there that you can watch. All of my radio shows, all the recordings are there on my website. Right back from my very first one in June of 2013. This is like my 84th interview, I think, Roberta.
Really? Wow.
And my email address is there. I'd love to hear comments or questions from your listeners. And so I look forward to hearing from everyone.
I love the book, and I want to make sure we get everything out of it that we can. It's available, of course, on Amazon, right? Where else will we find it?
Well, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Powell Books and Abe Books. All those online stores are listed on my website on the left sidebar. So yeah, all you have to do is just click on them, and you can get right to the site. So many bricks and mortar stores carry them as well. But if your favorite bookstore doesn't have it, they can order it for you. So it's fairly widely available, and it's available in lots of in the UK and South Africa and India and Ireland and Australia and so on. So it's available.
Great. So they've got distribution. That's fabulous.
Yeah,
that's one reason I love my publisher too, because she actually gets the books into stores internationally, which is very nice. Is it going to be translated into other languages than English?
Yeah, I haven't heard yet, Roberta. I'm hoping that it will at some point, but I have not heard that yet.
Well, Garnet, you're a delight. And if people are interested in just sort of getting to the meat of this, just read Dance of Heavenly Bliss. But if you want to see the story of someone whose mind is being blown initially and he really rises to the occasion, read all of his books. Begin with Dancing on a Stamp and just go through all three. I'm sorry, we've come to the end of our time. And so I'm just going to have to say, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end. And when you really get that, nothing in your life is going to be the same. Actually, I say that every time. I keep hoping if I say it often enough, you finally will really believe it, because it's true. If you want to learn more of the amazing things we're learning about our One Reality, of course, past episodes of Seek Reality are available on iTunes and on webtalkradio.net. My nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, Liberating Jesus and My Thomas, and of course my website is robertagrimes.com. Our guest next week will be Peter Wright. He's a therapist who is right on the cutting edge. He's a sweet man, too. Peter was with us recently to talk about removing negative attachments. So if you're interested in that, you can just look for that episode. Now he returns to talk about past life regression therapy. I've been looking for someone good to do this with because I've had personal experiences with past life regression. I can tell you that its ability to heal our psyches is miraculous. Don't miss this. Our guest today has been Garnet Schulhauser. He was a serious attorney all his life, and then the spirit world intervened. The books he's written about astral journeys with Albert, his spirit guide, are really entertaining. As I say, I can't vouch for all the things that he says happened, although I believe that he is an honest and sincere person. What gets me about his books is that the science is so perfectly right. Garnet is on the edge of what I could believe, but for you it may be easier and more enjoyable to believe everything he says. And the point is, he gets the details right. So I have to begin to believe, Garnet, that this is actually true, and I find it hard to say that, but that's the way it is. Dear friends, you and I are going to live forever. That's no longer in doubt, so please give yourself the joy of investigating and learning the truth while you're still here, because being certain that everyone you love is eternal is going to make you the happiest that you can be. But for now, please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in our One Reality, knowing that you are a powerful eternal being and you are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.